Right, tonight we're in chapter 7 of the book of Zechariah. Now, as we get into this book, we've already seen that it is a little more difficult to understand various things than some of the others. As we started out with Amos and Hosea, it was very easy to understand the messages that they had. But as we get into Zechariah, he has a lot of figurative language. He has a lot of apocalyptic language, and so it is more difficult. And tonight we will see that that continues to be the case. Now, the only thing that I want to do as far as reviewing is concerned is to go back and merely ask you this question. In the first six chapters, what has Zechariah's message been? Through all the visions, all of his preaching, everything is summarized in what? Rebuild the temple. That God is going to have that temple rebuilt, and so get busy and rebuild the temple. All right, now, in chapter 7, we start out now tonight, and we see that there is a teaching that we're going to get. I want to show you really what this teaching is, and then we will go ahead and get into it. But what it's going to be is that this present generation, the one that Zechariah was living in, this present generation is in danger of committing the same error as the previous generations, and we should learn from history. So what he's going to be telling them is, your forefathers made this mistake, don't you make it. Now, the mistake that we're going to see as you get down there is that he said, yea, they, that is, your forefathers, they made their hearts as an adamant stone, lest they should hear the law and the words which Jehovah of hosts had sent by his Spirit by the former prophets, that is, the prophets that came before the captivity. Therefore, there came great wrath from Jehovah of hosts. So the problem that your forefathers had was that they didn't listen to what God had to say. God told them that if you're wicked, he will take you into captivity. But if you will repent and turn to him with all of your heart, then he will protect you. Now, Zechariah is saying, we are about to make the same mistake. We've come back to rebuild the temple, but we're getting lax about this thing. Now, there's various things that cause them not to really get in and build that temple. We have to understand that if you put yourself back there, they were not unlike we are. That is, they had their own personal problems. When they came out of captivity, came back over into Jerusalem, into Judea, how many of them had houses to move into? None of them. What do you do when you move into a new city, when you move somewhere? What's the first thing you are concerned about? Where are we going to live? That's right. And so there were no places to live. So they had to build their places. Now, what do we do? Do we just go out and build a little tent and we live in this and get busy and build the house of God? Or do we go ahead and build our house and then build the house of God? They had those decisions to make. The nations around about them were giving them all kind of problems, all kind of troubles, trying to cause them to stop. Now, how do you feel when you have people trying to cause you problems and they are laughing at you, making fun of you, actually doing things physically to keep you from doing your job right? How do you feel about that? Is that discouraging or not? Very discouraging. And so these people had all of those things, and so they had become lax. Now, God sends Zechariah, what other prophet? Haggai, send these two prophets to exhort them, build the temple. Now, in chapter 7 then, that is what this message is all going to be about then, as we start out. All right, in the chapter 7, verse 1, it says, and it came to pass in the fourth year of King Darius, that the word of Jehovah came unto Zechariah in the fourth day of the ninth month, even in Shislev. Now, what we've got here is that in the fourth year and ninth month, King Darius. Now, that means that the date is about 2 years after he gave those eight visions. After he'd seen the eight visions, he exhorted them to build. Now then, we're down about 2 years later. And the time of the year would correspond to our December or January. Now, in the next verse, there's going to be some people from Bethel that are going to come down. And that's what chapter 7 is going to be about. Going to be built around these individuals that came down. Now, some people, when they returned back, they went up and built a city, or built their houses back up in Bethel. Now, we can read in Exodus 2:28 about Bethel, the establishment of it, in Nehemiah chapter 7, verse 32. Now, here he's a contemporary, and he shows us that there were some people that went up to Bethel to build their houses. All right, now, these people that are up there, by the way, if you're going from Jerusalem to Bethel, which way would you go? You go straight north. How many miles? 13. I'm smarter than you are because I read it. And so, the scholars tell us that it's about 13 miles up there. And so these people then come down from Bethel. Now, it said, now they of Bethel had sent, and then it names these fellows right here, these big long names, and their men to entreat the favor of Jehovah and to speak unto the priest of the house of Jehovah of hosts and to the prophets. Now, what prophets would these be? Haggai and Zechariah. So they want to talk to the priest. What was his name? The priest. Joshua. What was the leader of the movement to build the temple? Zerubbabel. All right. So it came down now to talk to them to find out what's going on. And so they said, should I weep in the fifth month, separating myself as I have done these so many years? Now, what they want to know is, here it is, on the fifth month, all of this 70 years, we have been weeping here in the fifth month. Now, what we find is this, that these people were having a fast day, as we will see. Well, let's just go ahead and read the next verse, then I'll come back to it. Then came the word of Jehovah of hosts, saying unto me, speak unto all the people of the land, and to the priests, saying, when ye fasted, now that fasting and weeping goes together, when ye fasted and mourned in the fifth and in the seventh month, even these 70 years, did ye fast unto me, even to me? And when ye eat and when ye drink, do ye not eat and drink for yourselves, or eat for yourselves and drink for yourselves? Now, what they came down and said, should we fast? All right, as we begin to talk about a fast, now, up here, the only authorized fast that you find in the Bible that God said that He wanted them to keep would be on the seventh month and the tenth day of the month. That would be the Day of Atonement. Now, that was to be a fast day. But these people have added a fast in the fifth month because that was a self-imposed fast. That was one that they set up themselves in memory of Nebuchadnezzar destroying the temple. That's when he came down to destroy the temple. So they said, we will fast now in this month. And then in the seventh month, that was in memory of the death of Gedaliah, which was their last ruler that was taken into captivity. So they had set up these fasts in addition to what the fast that God had told them to do. And evidently it was one of which God didn't care whether they fasted or not. You may or you may not. It doesn't make any difference. And so they set these up then. And so what they want to know is, now, since we've come out of captivity, should we continue to fast over the captivity? Or should we forget it? Well, God's answer, as He comes back to them then, is this. Well, even when you have been fasting, was it for you or was it for me? And when you do eat, do you eat for you or do you eat for me? Now, obviously, what is the answer to this rhetorical question? See, you come and ask me, should we continue to fast? And the truth of the matter is, your fasting never was in honor of me. Your fasting was always something that you wanted to do for yourself. And your eating was something that you wanted to do for yourself. So why come and inquire whether we should go ahead and do this thing that never was done, really, to my honor and glory anyway? Now in verse 7, he said, should you not hear the words which the Jehovah cried by the former prophets when Jerusalem was inhabited and in prosperity, and the cities thereof around about her, and the south and the lowlands were inhabited? In other words, that's what you should do. Instead of coming and asking, should we continue this self-imposed fast that we ourselves have levied upon us? Shall we keep our own laws in doing this? He said, you should ask the question, and you should go back and listen to the former prophets. Go back and listen to those prophets that your forefathers didn't listen to. Go back and see what Amos and Hosea and all of those men told your forefathers, that if they would do, God would protect them. If they didn't, what would happen? Go back and look at it. And get busy doing what they should have been doing, and that is what you need to be doing. All right, now in verse 8, and the word of Jehovah came into Zechariah, saying, thus hath Jehovah of hosts spoken, saying, execute true judgment. Now here's what he said, I want you to do. Forget about your own self-imposed fast. Forget about doing what you want to do. Go back and find out what I've already told you to do. No, it's kind of like this today. What would you do if I came in class next week and I said, you know, I've been worried sick all week. I've been wondering, what would God have me to do? What does God want me to do to please Him? Does He want me to keep Memorial Day or the 4th of July? Should I have a party on the 4th of July and shoot off firecrackers, or should I stay home and pray? I'm worried sick. What does God want me to do to be a Christian? What would you tell me? I don't know what to do. I need your help. What do I do on the 4th of July? Now, what's your answer going to be? Hey, fella, you're asking the wrong question, right? In other words, why come in here with that stupid question of what to do with the 4th of July? Why don't you go back to the book of God, where it's been all the time, where God has told you what He wants you to do? You should have been doing it all the time. Do you see the situation that I would be in if I came in and asked that question? That's exactly the situation that they're in. Now then, God said, since you answered it, ask it, I'm going to give it to you. Here's what I want you to do. Rather than trying to keep yourself imposed fast, He said, execute true judgment, and show kindness and compassion every man to his brother, and oppose not the widow, nor the fatherless, the sojourner, nor the poor, and let none of you devise against his brother in your heart, or devise evil against his brother in your heart. But they, your forefathers, refused to hearken or listen, and pulled away the shoulder and stopped their ears, that they might not hear. Now, he said, I'm going to tell you the same thing that the former prophets told your forefathers. What God wants you to do is execute true judgment or justice. Be faithful, be true, be just in all of your decisions. Now, what were some of the unjust things they were doing in their decisions back there? Taking property from the poor, taking bribes, preaching whatever the people wanted preached. In other words, you pay me and then I'll do this. And so, no, they were living for themselves, and they weren't living to execute true judgment there. Now, the next is, oppress not the fatherless and the poor and so forth. God says, I am their father, and if you do that, I will see that you are going to be held accountable for it. Let none of you devise evil against his brother. In Isaiah, he deals with it. And in Micah, he deals with it. Isaiah dealt with it with Israel. Micah deals with it with Judah. They were taking advantage of their brethren. And by the way, when they came back out of captivity, when we studied Nehemiah, what was one of those problems that Nehemiah ran into that he got word of by the grapevine that everybody was getting despondent and crying out, and they're saying, we don't have enough food, and when we borrow money, we borrow it off of our brethren, and they're charging us exorbitant interest. You remember that? And Nehemiah came in and said, you give it back to them, you restore all the money, and you do this and you do that. And so, yeah, they're still doing these things. Now, he says this, your forefathers refused to listen and pulled away the shoulder and stopped their ears. Now, pulling away the shoulder is this, that if you've got two oxen and you have them yoked together, those oxen must put their shoulders to that yoke in order to pull the wagon. All right, now, God said, I want you now to put your shoulders to the plow. You put your shoulders against that yoke and start pulling and doing what I tell you to do. Now here is a trick that an oxen will have. All animals try all different kind of tricks. And what they'll do is that they get in there and one oxen will hit that yoke and the other oxen will back up. The other oxen, instead of hitting it, it backs up and lets this oxen pull it all, and then they walk along like this. So you're walking along, you see, in this way, and one oxen is pulling it all. And they won't put their shoulders to the plow, is what we're saying. And that's the way your forefathers worked. They would not get in and do what I told them to do. And they plugged their ears. They stopped their ears. Well, that's what Isaiah said. He said that they've stopped their ears, that you've got wax in your ears, dirt in your ears, and you can't hear. And even when you hear, you can't hear. He goes ahead and tells them. And so, don't make the mistake your forefathers made. All right, 12. Yea, they made their hearts as an adamant stone. That people say is evidently the diamond, the hardest of all stones. They made their heart as adamant as a adamant stone there, lest they should hear the law. And the word which Jehovah of hosts had sent by his prophets, or by his spirit, by the former prophets. Therefore, there came great wrath from Jehovah of hosts. So your forefathers didn't listen, and now you're not. And it has come to pass, as he cried, and they would not hear, so they shall cry, and I will not hear, saith Jehovah of hosts, and I will scatter them with a whirlwind among all the nations which they have not known. Thus the land was desolate after them, so that no man passed through, nor returned, for they laid the pleasant land waste. And so, he said, God told him, if you will not listen, you will not obey, then I'll pull back, I'll send you into captivity, and this land will be desolate. So, chapter 7 is this then. Is Zechariah trying to encourage them, telling them, brethren, we are falling into the same situation, the same trap as our forefathers were, and we didn't know it. That seems to be the history of mankind. That we go through a serious problem in the church, in politics, in our families, whatever it is. We see the problems. Then if we get the solution, we come out of it. We'll come out of it, and then the next generation falls right back into it again. One thing that I've been impressed with as you study the books of history of the Old Testament is that you find that there'll be a generation of people that serves God. But what will the next generation do? They degenerate. And then they degenerated and get down, and God then would bring problems in their life, and then they'd turn to God, and the next generation come back up. And it's a pathetic thing, and something that really hurts, really, to think that if you happen to be living in a zealous generation, your children are probably going to be dull, old, bored people, spiritually speaking. Now, it doesn't have to be, but society goes that way. And you can see it. It'll go, and there'll be a zealous period of time in our life, and then everything just seems to calm down, and nobody's zealous for the Lord.
Mm-hmm. How were their months in a year divided? How many months
12.
Did they have?
12. Mm-hmm. Same as we do. Mm-hmm. They just started their months in a different time, about 3 months, 3 months after we do ours.
Oh, I thought mm-hmm. it was 12 months. In a lot later.
No, they went by the moon, and the moon going by the cycle of the moon. Mm-hmm. All right, now we turn to chapter 8. And as we turn to chapter 8 now, here we find that we have two things that I want to call your attention to. In chapter 8, it looks forward to the future, where chapter 7 looked back to the past. Chapter 7 says, your chapter 7 look back to the past. Chapter 7 says, you're about to fall into the same problem your forefather did. But now chapter 8 is going to be an encouraging chapter. And it's going to be a chapter to tell what's going to happen in the future. And here the message is going to be, well, you can guess it as well as I, what's the message going to be? It will turn out all right. See, God is in control. See, good things are going to happen. So that's what we're going to get in chapter 8. Now, an interesting thing is, in this chapter, a total of 16 times, we have Zechariah asserting, "Thus saith the Lord," in some way or another. 10 times he says, "Thus saith Jehovah of hosts." 4 times he says, "Saith Jehovah." 2 times, "The word of Jehovah of hosts came to me." A total of 16 times in this chapter, he drives that point home. God said. This is what God Himself has said. All right. Now then we turn to the 8th chapter. And it's going to be pointing into the future. So here's what he said. "And the word of Jehovah of hosts came to me, saying, Thus saith Jehovah of hosts, I am jealous for Zion with a great jealousy, and I am jealous for her with great wrath. Now in my jealousy, I will be expending wrath." Now he has expended wrath already upon Zion, Jerusalem, Judah. He's already done that by punishing them. Now who do you suppose that he will expend wrath upon now due to his jealousy? If a man has an unfaithful wife, and she is doing what Israel did, and what book is it that says Israel was an unfaithful wife and dealt with that? Hosea. All right, now, if a man has an unfaithful wife, if he is jealous over her, really cares about her, how will he expend his wrath? On what two people? On her and on the person she has been unfaithful with. So, God has been jealous over Israel, and he took her into captivity to try to straighten her up, to try to get her to come to her senses. Now then, he will shower his wrath upon anybody that tries to come in and keep her from doing what God wants her to do. So verse 3, "Thus saith Jehovah, I am returned unto Zion." Hey, wait a minute. That is quite a statement. "I am returned unto Zion and will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem." Do you remember that I asked you this question? Think about it now before you answer. It's a trick question. Either way you answer it, you're wrong. We've got this captivity, 70 years. Why did they go into captivity? Somebody said sin, just as wrong as it can be. David, how many times have I told you that they went in because of sin? Where'd you ever get that idea? Have you ever heard that before? Well, sure, he's heard me say it how many times? They went in because of sin. That's why I say it's trick. No, that's not really the reason they went in. Why'd they go in? Because God left them. Now, why did God leave them, Dave? There it is, because of sin, see? And so, as I say, it's a trick question. But Ezekiel deals with this, the other prophets deal with it, that these people were in sin, and if you don't straighten out your sin, God's going to take you into captivity. Then Ezekiel deals with it and shows how it happened. That during this 70-year period of time, God left them. He left. He went away. Now then, at the end of this period of time, God has come back. And during this period of time, they were left for whom? Who were they left to? Their idols. Weren't they? In other words, they went in because of idolatry, because of their sins. So God left them with their idols. And what did their idols do for them during that 70 years? How much comfort did He give them? None. And when they came out without their idols, see? And God says, now I am coming back. All right, so since God is coming back then, what can we expect from here on? When we see that God returns in here then, what can we expect from here on out? Success. Good things are going to happen. They went into captivity because God had left them. All right, now then in verse 4. In verse 3, the middle part right here, it said, "Thus saith Jehovah, I am returned unto Zion, will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem shall be called the city of truth, the mountain of Jehovah, the host, the holy mountain. Thus saith Jehovah of hosts, there shall yet old men and old women dwell in the streets of Jerusalem, every man with his staff in his hand for very age," that is, very old age. "And the streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing in the streets thereof. Thus saith Jehovah of hosts." In other words, what is that a picture of? Instead of Jerusalem being desolate, what is the picture of? People live to be an old age, and the boys and the girls play in the street, and everybody's happy and contented and peaceful. And in other words, Jerusalem is going to be restored in the way God would have it to be. Now he said, if it be marvelous in the eyes of the remnant of this people in those days, should it also be marvelous in my eyes, saith Jehovah of hosts? Now, if me restoring this city that was totally desolated over here, it was totally desolated, it was plowed under, it was dragged with a drag clean, everything was totally destroyed. Over here, God comes back and says, I will make it a magnificent city again. Now, that looks impossible to human beings. It just looks like it could never happen. God said, if it be marvelous, if it looks impossible to you people, does that mean it ought to look impossible to me? No, I'm God. No problem. Jerusalem will be restored. Why? Because God is with them. See, that's the reason. Because God is with them. Now, in verse 7, thus saith Jehovah of hosts, behold, I will save my people from the east country and from the west country, and I will bring them, and they shall dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God in truth and in righteousness. So, he says now, I will bring back my people, and they're going to come now from the east and from the west, and they will be my people. Now, we have already pointed this out, that over here we come to the cross of Christ, and then we come on over here into the spiritual kingdom. And there are statements such as this that makes you wonder, is he talking about this right here? Is he talking about the restoration, number one? Or is he talking about the spiritual kingdom, number two? Or is he talking about it starting, beginning to happen here, and continues right on over here? Do you see that point getting at? I think that we can see that if it really started here, in other words, he's bringing them back from Assyria, he's bringing them back from Babylon, they are coming back, dribbling back in here, and over here, where does God call his people from? Everywhere. And so that's why it's kind of hard to, and sometimes just to pinpoint. Now, later on tonight, we'll be able to pinpoint a few things. But some of these things, it started there and goes right on. Now, verse 9. Thus saith Jehovah of hosts, let your hands be strong, ye that hear in these days these words from the mouth of the prophets that were in the days of the foundation of the house of Jehovah of hosts was laid. Who were the prophets when the foundation was laid? That's right. Haggai and Zechariah. See? Even the temple that it might be built. For before those days, now before you laid the foundation, think about this. There was no hire for man, nor any hire for beast, neither was there any peace to him that went out or came in because of the adversary. You had a lot of adversaries around you. For I set all men, everyone against his neighbor. Now let's go back and think about what Haggai had to say. You remember what Haggai had to say about them financially in chapter 1? What was the condition? Before they laid the foundation, Haggai came on the scene. What did he say about them financially? You are a total failure. In other words, you go out and you plow the ground and you try to harvest, but whatever you do, you have crop failure. And when you make wages and you put it in your purse or in your bag, it's like putting it in a bag with what? With holes in the bottom. Even if you save it up, I have ways of taking away from you. Now, what was God doing that for? Why was he causing crop failure? Why was he causing financial disasters? And why was he causing other nations to give them problems? To bring them back to their senses. To get them to stop and say, what is going wrong? And we need to return to God. And that's where he told them, build the temple. You think it's time to put your houses ahead of the house of God? Get busy and build the temple, and then God will be with you. See, that was what Haggai's message was. All right, now, Zechariah is calling their attention to that. Now, when you did get busy, and you built the and you laid the foundation, and then you started to build, God was with you. God blessed you. But now then, it's tough times again. Evidently, they had, you see, become lax one more time. So, the people of God going up and down. All right, 11. But now, he says, now that's the way it was, but now, starting right now, I will not be unto the remnant of the people as in the former days, saith Jehovah of hosts. For there shall be seed of peace. The vine shall give its fruit. The ground shall give its increase. The heavens shall give their due. And I will cause the remnant of this people to inherit all these things. And it shall come to pass that as you were a curse among the nations, O house of Judah and house of Israel, so will I save you, and ye shall be a blessing. Fear not, but let your hands be strong. So, now, I am coming back now, and I'm going to bless you. I want to say it again. They say it 100 more times, I'm not sure. You are going to be blessed from this point on. You will be blessed. What? I'm back. See? God has returned. And this will come to pass. See? This will come to pass. So, from here on, now, we're going to change this. We're going to build up this nation so that that Christ can come. In verse 14, Thus saith Jehovah of hosts, as I thought to do evil unto you when your fathers provoked me to wrath, saith Jehovah of hosts, I repented not. So again have I thought in these days to do good to unto Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. Fear ye not. So, saying the same thing again. I did them evil. I brought bad days upon them. Now I'm going to bring good days. These are the things that ye shall do. Now, by the way, why is it that God brings those famines and disasters upon His people? Why did He just do it arbitrarily? No, never arbitrarily. Always does it for the same reason that a parent spanks or chastises a child. And that is because the child is unruly. Israel was unruly. Israel was in rebellion. Israel was sinning. And so God would chastise them. And now then, I'm going to bless you. And since I'm going to bless you, what do I expect you to do? What do you tell your kid? Kid said, I don't want any more whippings. Okay, I won't give you any more whippings. If. And that is what God is saying here. So here's what God says now you are to do. Speak you every man the truth with his neighbor. Execute the judgment of truth and peace in your gates. And let none of you devise evil in your hearts against his neighbor. And love no false oath. For all these are things that I hate, saith Jehovah. So, he says, get busy. Do the moral things that you ought to do. Notice right here that speak you every man truth with his neighbor. And execute the judgment of truth and peace in your gates. What do you do in the gates? We don't do it in the gates today. Execute judgment of peace and truth in the gates. How would we say that? Execute judgment of peace in where? In the courts. That's right. Make sure that your courts are honest and upright. And let none of you devise evil in your hearts against his neighbor. So all of those are how you treat your neighbor. And love no false oath. Don't you take an oath or don't you swear by any other God other than Jehovah. And when you swear by Jehovah, then you keep your oath, is what he's saying. Because I hate all those things. So don't you do that. If you flip back to chapter 5, that flying roll, that vision, you remember? That flying roll. What was written on one side? What was written on the other side? There's something written on one side and something written on the other side. What was written on one side? What?
God, your attitude towards God on one side.
All right.
Your attitude towards man on the other.
Don't swear falsely on one side. What did it say on the other side? What? Wasn't there something about truth in there? You see, on the other side. And that is that you are to you're not to do certain things. Verse 3. This is a curse that goeth forth over the whole land. For everyone that stealeth shall be cut off on one side according to it, and everyone that sweareth I was thinking this truth. Maybe it's on over here in another place here that I'm thinking about. So one side is dealing with deal with your fellow man correctly. The other side is deal with God correctly. All right, verse 18. And the word of Jehovah of hosts came unto me, saying, Thus saith Jehovah of hosts, the fast of the fourth month, and the fast of the fifth month, and the fast of the seventh month, and the fast of the tenth month, shall unto the house of Judah, or shall be unto the house of Judah, joy and gladness and cheerful hearts, therefore love, truth, and peace. Now, here we have these various fasts. And they had made up more fasts that they were practicing. In the 10th month, they were fasting because Nebuchadnezzar come against Jerusalem that month. In the 4th month, that's when the breach was made in the wall. And when the breach is made in the wall, that's the same as captivity. In other words, the next thing to happen is then the army comes through captivity. The 5th month was the burning of the temple, and the 7th month was a murder and get a life. Now, God hadn't told them to make a fast in any of these days. In other words, these were not required fast days. So God said, all of these fast days that you set up for yourself are going to be days of joy. No, don't keep these days as fast days. And don't keep remembering all the bad times you've had. They're going to be turned into days of joy. Thus saith Jehovah of hosts, It shall come to pass that there shall come peoples and inhabitants of many cities, and the inhabitants of one city shall go to another, saying, Let us go speedily to entreat the favor of Jehovah and to seek Jehovah of hosts, and I will go also. Yea, many peoples and strong nations shall come to seek Jehovah of hosts in Jerusalem and to entreat the favor of Jehovah. Thus saith Jehovah of hosts, In those days, it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold out of the languages of the nations. They shall take hold out of the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, We will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. Now, the reason I repeated that in those days is talking about in some particular time. Now, some particular time, the Gentiles from all of these various nations, and in fact it says 10 men. What does the number 10 represent where it goes through and 10? It's total, totality of things. And meaning all the nations, people from every nation. One day is going to run and grab a hold of the skirt of a Jew and say, We want to become part of you because we've heard that God was with you. See? That's the thing that they're going to be crying there. Now, what I've got right here is this. When you take a look at this, what does it mean? 10 men should take hold of a Jew. The day will come when the Jew, who was once a despised, a cursed, and a byword, will be sought after by the nations. What's another word for the nations? Gentiles. Whereas the Gentiles had taken them into captivity, hated them, used them as a byword, they're going to come back. Now we ask the time, when was it? Was it during the time before Christ or during the time after Christ? Are we talking about during this period or are we talking about this period over here? Well, the fact of the case is that history tells that during this time, many of the Gentiles did see that the Jews were blessed by their God, and they did come and want to join with the Jews. What do we call those people, the Gentiles that came and said, I want to be a Jew? A proselyte. That's right. So when we come into the time of Christ, right in here, we had a lot of proselytes. Now, as you come over here after the cross of Christ, I've given some illustrations up there. The first one is Cornelius. Cornelius was a Gentile, but he was a proselyte. He had, not necessarily a proselyte. No, he wasn't a proselyte. He was a Gentile that had joined himself to the Jews, how shall I put it, manner of life or way of thinking. Now, a proselyte is someone who would have been circumcised and have become a Jew in religion. Cornelius was not that type of individual. He was a Gentile, an uncircumcised Gentile, but he was a man that respected the Jews, and he was a man that lived according to the law that the Jews had. the moral laws. And he had a great respect of God, for God. And so he was the first man that the gospel went to. In Acts 13, verse 7, there with old Elymas, that evil man, there were men of understanding and by the name of Paulus. And they sought after Paul and they said, tell us these things. They were Gentiles. In Acts 13:43, they devout proselytes. Acts 17:4, there were devout Greeks that came and obeyed the gospel. How many countries have Gentiles come from to join themselves to Jesus Christ and said, we want to become a part of Jesus Christ? Every country on the face of the earth, see? And so that's what he is saying right here. And all of this came to pass by what nation that brought the Christ in? The Jewish nation, see? Brought the Christ in, and people flocked then to that. Now, in chapter 9, if you'll notice here in chapter 9, we're getting into the third division of the book. Now, as we get into the third division, it goes from chapter 9 through chapter 14. This is the last division. We want to get a good start on it here tonight. Now, I have typed off here some things that Homer Haley has said in his commentary, which I think are very good. Now, in this, we start out, the first division is chapters 9, 10, and 11. Now, in this particular speech that Zechariah is going to give, he says, the prophet deals with the fall of the heathen nations and the coming of the king who would rule in peace. But when he would come, he would be rejected as a shepherd, despised and cast away, to be sold for a paltry price of a wounded slave. Now, does that pretty well sound like the Christ that you know? Alright, Zechariah is going to be dealing with that. Zechariah is, in this section, is going to say, the nations will fall. They will not win out over the kingdom of God. But when the Messiah comes, he's going to be rejected. Now, in the second part, it presents in further detail the rejection of the shepherd and the victory of the kingdom of God in spite of his having been refused. When you think about, I want you to think about this, way back here where Zechariah is, as he is back here, and he's prophesying about this over here. Isn't it rather unique and unusual, odd and strange, that you would prophesy that there's going to be a king come and he's going to be victorious, but he's going to be rejected? In other words, if suppose I told you the next president of the United States in the next election is going to be a man who will be victorious. He will set this country on a right path. He will make every decision that is right. He will bring peace and prosperity. He'll be the greatest president that we've ever seen, in spite of the fact that all the American people, most of us, will vote against him. He will be rejected. We'll even kill the fellow. But he's going to be victorious. What would you think of me if I told you that about the next president? You say, that sounds contradictory. It does. All right? Think about, that's what it sounded like to those people that Zechariah is preaching to. See, you and I know the story of Christ. And we know that they did reject him. We know that they put him to death. And we know he raised from the dead and he did establish his kingdom. But think about what it sounded like to the people that Zechariah is preaching to. It sounded like that president that I talked about a minute ago. All right. Now, as we start with this, there's one other thing that he says that I want to read verbatim, because I think it's very excellent. He says, both sections, that is from here on out, in the book of Zechariah, both sections are interspersed with prophecies of the Messiah, which are quoted in the New Testament and applied to Christ who came in view of the admitted difficulty of these chapters. We're going to get into some tough chapters. And in the light of Peter's claim that no prophecy of Scripture is a private interpretation, for no prophecy ever came by the will of man, but men spake from God, being moved by the Holy Spirit, it seems wise to build one's interpretation upon these chapters around the passages that are quoted by Jesus and the New Testament writers. Now, what he's saying is, Peter has made the assertion that no prophecy is a private interpretation. Now, what that means is, it doesn't mean that you can't privately interpret, that you can't sit down and privately study. What it means is that no prophecy ever came by private interpretation. Every prophecy, including all these that we're going to read with Zechariah, none of them ever came like this. Zechariah goes home, and he sits down and scratches his head, and he says, "Now I wonder what is going to happen. I'm going to try to figure this thing out." So he reads some books, he researches it out, he gets everything together, and he says, "Now, here is my private understanding. Here's the way I understand this." And so he then sits down and writes what he thinks. That's private interpretation. See? Now, no prophecy ever came in that way. All prophecy came a different way. Prophecy came through Zechariah without Zechariah ever thinking about it, without him ever having to decide what needs to be said or what's going to be done. So Zechariah and Isaiah and all these men would go out and they would preach these things. And then, after Zechariah preaches and Isaiah, the king is coming. He is victorious. He cannot be defeated. There is no way that he will be overcome. His kingdom will be victorious. Everybody will reject him and he'll be put to death. Can you imagine what he thought when he went home that night and sat down? Scratched his head. Do you think he understood that? Now, what does Peter say about those prophets? He said, what did he say that they did? They wondered what time or what manner of time was I talking about today? They didn't know. They didn't understand. And they died not understanding. They died not understanding. But Peter said, but to you and me, it has been revealed. They said this for our benefit. So you and I can understand these things, but they didn't. Now, since Zechariah spoke by the Holy Spirit, and the Holy Spirit in the New Testament interprets many of these things, then we need to use that interpretation that he gives to say, this is what he's talking about. Now that's what Homer is talking about in this particular thing. All right, let's get started. It said, the burden of the word of Jehovah. Now when you see the word burden, many prophets have used that, the burden. What is it? What does burden say? Now I'm going to tell you about Mitch's burden. And then next week I'm going to tell you about the burden of Pauline. What am I talking about? Something good or something bad? All right, the heavy load that's going to be cast upon them. That's it. It's a bad thing. Here's something that you're going to have to bear, and it's not a good thing. All right, now the burden of the word of Jehovah unto the land of Habrak and Damascus shall be its resting place, for the eye of man and all the tribes of Israel is toward Jehovah. And Hamath also, which bordereth thereof, and Tyre and Sidon, because they are very wise. I want to stop and we go back up here in that Hadrach. We don't really know where that is. That place has never been found. The word means strong, weak. Strong, weak. And it has caused some of the better scholars to conclude that this is talking about nation of Persia, of which Cyrus was that king that let them go. Cyrus was a strong king. But after Cyrus, his offspring came along, and they were very effeminate men. They were weaklings. They could not make decisions. And the country just disintegrated under their weak, effeminate leadership. So many of them think that since nobody knows where that place is, that it may be a name that is given to the country as a whole, the country of Persia, asked a strong, weak country. The country that was powerful, strong, could conquer Babylon, and then turned into the most sissified, mushy nation, you see, that you could tell. That may be it. It may be a city up there. I don't know. And really, we don't have to know. What it's talking about is all of these Gentile areas in there, such as up in Damascus, and if that Hadrach means that, then it's talking about over into Babylon and Persia in that area, all of that, and Hamath and Tyre and Sidon. Now, something's going to happen to all these because, look at Tyre and Sidon, because they are very wise. What does that mean? That's irony. They're smart alecks. Oh, they are so wise in their own eyes. They know everything. They don't have to depend on God for anything, so they're going to be destroyed. See, is what it is. And so he goes ahead and tells about how Tyre built herself up and had gold and all of that and silver and just got riches and riches and riches. And it goes on down through. And the whole point is, down in the first 7 verses, what he does is pick out these strong centers of power and says, I will destroy them. Now what would it mean today if God spoke through somebody and said, Moscow, Washington, D.C., Tokyo, London, going to fall? What's the point that we would get at? We'd understand. That's what he's doing here. Taking these strong centers, God is going to intervene. God has come back. No enemy will ever prevail over God's people. Now look at verse 8. God says, and I will encamp about my house against the army. Now his house would be the house of Judah. I will encamp about my house here, that none pass through or return, and no oppressor shall pass through them any more, for now have I seen with mine eyes. In other words, I have seen the oppressors come. I have seen how they have treated my people. And I took my people into their hands. It'll never, ever happen again. Nobody is going to come in and conquer my people ever again. See, is what he's saying. Now, look in verse 9. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, thy king cometh unto thee. He is just and having salvation, lowly, and riding upon an ass, even upon a colt, the foal of an ass. Now, does that identify anything? Yeah, we know. You see, now then, we can turn over to Matthew 21 and definitely identify the thing that we're talking about. Now, right there's where I'm going to close. And we will begin with that verse next week. But notice now of what he is saying here. He is saying that God has returned, and nations that have mutilated his people will no longer, from this time on, will no longer conquer and mutilate my people. Now it's an interesting thing when you study, after we get through with one more prophet, there'll be a period of 400 years between the last Old Testament prophet and the coming of Christ. And during this period of time, the enemies of God's people attempted in every way they could to try to destroy them. This is the time of when Alexander the Great came and he conquered the world. It's the time of when people tried to desecrate the Jewish religion. It's the time of when they came in and offered pig broth in the altar and spread the blood of hogs and pigs around in the temple to desecrate it. It was a period of time when God's people didn't have any king. They didn't have any leaders. It was a period of time of when they're there exposed and they're hopeless. And then the Roman government came. And that's the government that was in charge when Jesus came on the scene. The Jews, were there still Jews there when Christ came? No, did they come through that whole thing, unbelievable thing, and get over here? Now, what we've just seen is, God has promised them, I will be with you. See? I will be with you. Now, they went through a lot of tribulation, but he was with them. And then over here, we have the spiritual kingdom, and God is with us. God's promise says, never again will my people ever be destroyed by foreign nations. So we have that promise. And it all hinges around this right here. All hinges around thy king cometh. Thy king cometh riding on the foal of an ass. So that's where we'll start then next week. And so you can see where Zechariah is taking us, right down into that spiritual kingdom. That's where we'll put it.